There's probably three things. One is there's a lot of popular user demand for. Two is definitely parity, because the protocols on Chain, certain operations, it's going to be more difficult to do. So we have to brainstorm a bit of what is like an operation that you can normally do, like another marketplace. And then three is trying to get people internally on the team to be using the product, noticing pain points. So ensuring that people on the team are power users so they can identify things themselves.
Scraping Bits is brought to you by the following sponsors: MEV Protocol. Maximize your ETH staking value with MEV ETH, exclusively on MEV.io. And Composable. Execute any intent on any chain, coming soon to Mantis.app. That's MANTIS.APP. And Fastlane Labs, the only MEV and intent-centric team that has a daily deodorant application rate of over 68%. GM, GM, everyone. My name's Degachi, the host of Scraping Bits, and today I have a special guest, Owen. How's it going, man?
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, of course. It's a pleasure to have you on. I've been following you for quite some time since I started my career, and I've seen you progress over the years as well. It's great to finally chat. We've DM'd a little bit. We've never actually spoken.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. I think the first time we talked was about having some of the smart contract code that I'd written on GitHub. And then I think since then, you've done so much more in terms of picking up Mev and doing all sorts of other things.
Yeah, exactly. I remember the first DMs were like in May of 2021. Yeah, just looking into your project, OXMons, and the generative side of that stuff, I think that was pretty cool. And you had your own personal website, and that kind of blew up. And then you went into the rabbit hole of just building little projects and actually showing them on your website, which is pretty cool. I did the same thing, but I never showed them on my website. I guess that's like a little segue into who are you and what you do.
Yeah, on Twitter, I use the handle ZeroXMons, and that comes from this NFT project that I did over a little over 2 years ago now. And the project there is like a mix of Pokemon and Lovecraft. So you've got these like GAN-generated pixel animations. There's some like metadata that's using the Wikipedia descriptions and some other texts from like the Lovecraft entities mashed together. There was originally like a community of collectors that formed around there. And then a lot of my sort of projects spun out from interacting with that community. And that's the handle that I use.
Yeah, it's super interesting. How did you even get into building these little pixel monsters?
So that was like a side project that sort of got shelved a long time ago, like before I really touched blockchain stuff. And then I got more involved in DeFi summer. So yeah, farming Wi-Fi, seeing the launch of Sushi, those are big things then. And then one thing that hadn't taken off as much was thinking about NFTs. So I was like, okay, maybe instead of trying to dive straight into DeFi, there's a more low stakes project I can start with. And then that was when I was like, oh, well, I can resharpen up and combine like the scan stuff that was just in a folder from a while ago with this NFT thing.
Yeah. And you must have been into like AI before though for quite some time. Or was it just you tried it out one day, put it in a folder, came back to it a couple years later or something?
So the generative stuff was pretty new to me, but I was interested in like a lot of areas in AI as like a whole before this.
Were you like studying it before or just interested?
Yeah. So I had done some more like formal schooling in that and was also looking at research roles in that area before I did this big pivot.
Yeah. So you were just like in Web 2 finishing school, or I guess still in school. I don't know what your status in that is, but around there, you were just like dabbling in Web 2 basically. And then blockchain popped up and you're like, oh shit, let me try this.
Yeah. The correct story that's a little bit funny that I tell people is originally I thought I wanted to do a PhD in AI stuff, and then I got rejected from all of the grad schools I applied to.
Oh, so it's like,
fuck, I guess blockchain engineer is my next choice now.
It's all coming into fruition.
Yeah, I think it was all like, okay, this is making sense. And then the inevitable GPT-4 coming out, and now it's very real.
Oh yeah, definitely. I think if anyone wants to get into AI, they can really just do it in Google, right? And just play around and get into it like that. There's no real need for a formal education anymore because Google's so just damn powerful.
I think for builders in particular, the barrier to entry has gone down so much. Literally in an afternoon, you can hack something really interesting just using one of these APIs. But I do think that if you're really motivated on the technical side to try and figure out what's going on, you really can't escape the math.
Oh, yeah, for sure. It keeps on popping up in random places, even when you're like least expected as well.
Yeah, I remember reading on your blog, you mentioned at one point you wanted to tackle linear algebra. Did you end up getting that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, so it's like a weird thing for me. It's I only learn something if I absolutely need it. So like my whole approach when learning or at least building something is, okay, how do I simplify this into like basic steps? And then through that, it's okay, what do I need? What's necessity to basically accomplish this first step? And through that is what I choose to learn, basically. Yeah, I was given advice from another Mev team. You should learn linear algebra and some other things. And I was like, okay, cool. I should probably look into this. I looked into it for 2 days and I just hate math. And I'm like a very practical person when it comes to implementing things. Otherwise, I just don't remember it. And so I was like, okay, let's try this. And then I didn't have anything to apply it to. So I was just like, wait, this is pointless. For now, at least. But I'm sure it has its purpose somewhere. It comes down the road. I'll be like, this could have helped.
That's all cool. Yeah, I think that the being motivated by necessity or pragmatism is a very valid way of approaching it. And if it's not being used immediately, then there are probably other pressing things that can command your attention.
Yeah, exactly. It's just a priority kind of cue. And then that will get you to the next destination much faster than just putting all the priority stuff in the back end and then coming to it later. Speaking on basically building, how did you come up with basically PseudoSwap? How did you find the opportunity and then just go for it? Because you built some other stuff as well. You built like a bundler where you just throw in like different ERC20s and send them all off as one transaction, basically.
So that's really funny because 6551 is really taking off now. And you know, like various ERCs prior that have done different types of token composability. So it's just been interesting to see this is the one that is sort of finally getting traction and integration across major projects.
Yeah, so how did you basically get to building PseudoSwap?
Like you mentioned, I was trying a lot of things, building a lot of these like small self-contained projects like mini dApps. And then one of the things that people in the NFT community had wanted was like a way to trade stuff, maybe multiple things at a time. And there wasn't really like a tool that could enable that. So at the time I was like, oh, maybe I could make something that could like, we'll trade their 0x bonds NFTs with each other. And then thinking about it more, I was like, okay, it doesn't need to just be 0x bonds NFTs, right? It could be NFTs in general. And then had a good friend, Steve Klabanoff, who used to work at 0x. And he was like, hey, you don't have to write all this from scratch. You should take a look at what you can do with the 0x protocol. I did. And that was how the first version of the PseudoSwap OTC site came to be. That version is actually like up on GitHub. People can download and run it locally if they want. And there's no server involved at all, right? You just generate the signature client side, store like a Base64 encoded version of it. And then that's what you send to your friend, which then reconstructs the signature, pairs with the other one, and then they can submit.
It was like a private platform to begin with, and then it expanded into this public platform, right?
Yeah, so then that was there. And then 2021 summer came around, which was like huge for JPEGs.
Oh, yeah.
So then it took on a lot more use. And then a lot of my thinking was like, okay, is there a way to make it more like a normal marketplace? At the same time, early in the year, I'd been a contributor at FTX, which really pioneered the idea of NFT liquidity. So my thinking there was like, are there other ways that people might be able to do similar liquidity positioning, but maybe you don't have to put up like both sides of the token and the NFT? So like UniV3 inspired. And then my thinking there was like, okay, some people might just want to sell their NFTs for ETH, and other people might just want to buy on the way down, but not do the reverse, right? I guess these are like take profit orders or stop loss orders in like the UniV3 sense. But I didn't really think of an easy way to integrate those. And it wasn't until a few months later that I was like, oh, if you segregate each person into managing like their own pricing, then you can do some like aggregation on top. And then the totality of the orders can behave more like the sort of aggregate AMM curve, or like the aggregate order book. So I wrote this like really short PDF about this idea, and then reached out to some friends and I was like, hey, I think this is really cool. We should definitely build it out. And then fast forward a year later, that's when the first version got released.
Yeah, I remember that when it was just like a simple website, just a V1 website. And I was like, wow, okay, this is pretty big. Because at the time, I remember using your private version. I was like, wait, okay, what if there's a public one? I started building a public one. But then you released your public one. I'm like, oh no. But yeah, it was such a brilliant idea. Basically, just trading on chain, no trust. It's just all contracts. And it even created some MEV as well, like basically OpenSea to PseudoSwap MEV.
Yeah, that's something that other people have mentioned as well.
Yeah, it's basically like arbitrage. So someone would put up basically an NFT on PseudoSwap for, I don't know, another NFT that might be like cheaper or even just ETH. And then they'll buy it off PseudoSwap and sell it on OpenSea or basically the reverse. So they'll buy on OpenSea, sell on PseudoSwap to the person asking. It's created this a whole new like NFT dynamic, which is quite interesting. And I think entirely unintentional as well.
Yeah, I feel like that in part is always something that happens when there's like market fragmentation, because then you end up with pricing mismatches. Going back to the original point, though, I do think that making sure that as much as possible smart contracts can be like first-class citizens has definitely been like a big part of design versus something that's like a signed order book model. Like, it's very much in like my interest to encourage people to find ways of building on top of the pool infrastructure, because there's like only a few ways that a smart contract like signal an intent to sell or like purchase NFTs at the current landscape.
Yeah, you just basically go on the big platforms right now, and that's basically it. It's all aggregated in a way. Yeah, so you basically built this V1 version with some friends, and they're still on the team, right? Did you end up hiring anyone else?
Originally, I was the person who was doing like all of the front end stuff and some of the smart contract stuff, a good amount of the testing. And there was a lot of people using the site when it first came out like a year ago. And like the small team was definitely not enough. So eventually grew it a bit and then started thinking about ways to fill in where the protocol fell short, I think, in the first version. So that's the version that's out today. And then also got more people to help out cleaning up the site, making it look nicer. So it's come a long way from the original GIMP edited vaporwave aesthetics on the OTC site.
Yeah, for sure. How did you really find these people to hire? What was like the process of hiring, I guess? Or was it just friends?
Friend referrals, I think, definitely help. I think hiring in Web3 is always tricky. Feels like there's definitely more sus candidates, right? Like you can literally hire a North Korean hacker. So I feel like friend referrals definitely really good. That, and then a few times it was like people from related NFT communities that had used the product before and were familiar with it. So those were, I think, the two avenues that helped a lot with finding people.
Yeah, for sure. And was it an interview kind of thing, or did you give them a quick task? How did you go about that to like filter?
Yeah, it was usually like quick talk just to make sure that the product is something they're familiar with or at least want to learn more about. And then for us, usually getting people started is more important than like trial tasks. So, or like then like programming interviews. So we would prefer like a trial task. Hey, let's like find something to work on together and see like how that works for both of us and then decide rather than here's more leak code problems.
I agree. There's like people out there that just basically study these questions and then pass all of them, then get into the company and just completely don't know what to do. So you basically gave them like quick tasks, saw how they got along. So you just did this one by one, or did you have multiple people working on multiple tasks?
And the pace was very slow. It was like adding one person sort of at a
Okay.
time.
So it's like a massive wait line for the next person.
I think that there's different approaches when scaling, right? If you need a lot of talent, then you're going to have to paralyze it a bit. In our case, like I have some preference for the team staying smaller. So there's sometimes we can be a little bit pickier. Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. How did you really manage going from building the solo to basically building a company, if that's what you would call it? How did you manage all the hats and do all that stuff? Because it does get quite hard.
It's definitely rocky. One of my co-founders, Xerox Hamachi on Twitter, he's definitely like more keyed into the PM angle than I am. I'm definitely like a lot more dev leaning. Really big shout out to him for pointing out when he was like, hey, I think this is when we need to be stepping back. Yeah, I think like definitely the hardest thing is like going from doing dev all the time to try to like provide support for people to do the dev.
Yeah, because as a dev, you just want to keep devving basically. But it is like an essential when you scale to get everyone on board and make sure the vibe is correct and all that stuff. So what was like the difficulties of basically scaling and getting to where you are at now?
I think that we talked about briefly earlier, I think hiring was always still difficult, right? Even with, so I would say that one was hard, and it was like a good amount of time before we felt happy with, okay, we have someone to cover all the different roles across the stack, like front end, back end. That was a big one. And then I think the other thing too is like figuring out how much you can take on your plate, estimating timelines when you're like a single person, you have a good sense for like how much you can get done. But now if the team has grown to double the size, you can take on more stuff. So you can be a little bit more ambitious, but you probably can't take on two times the amount of stuff.
Yeah, for sure. Scaling is definitely useful, but it's also a change in mindset as well, because some devs want to do it all. That's like me. I want to do it all the time. And you have to let go. You got to let go and trust your team as well. So I think the hiring process is definitely incredibly, it's such a crucial part of the process of scaling. And you've got to add the right people, because if they're not aligned with your values and your goal, just like the founder is, then I guess it's not going to work out too well. And I assume that's what you found when you hired these new people. Yeah. So I guess the next kind of point I want to touch on is when you scale, how do you really choose what features to add, and what's the process of getting everyone on board to do the same thing?
Yeah, I think that there's like probably three things. One is obviously like, what there's a lot of like popular user demand for. So, you know, if there's something that is being requested, trying to figure out like where that can slot in. Two is definitely like parity, because the protocols on Chain, certain operations, like it's going to be more difficult to do, especially in the gas efficient way. So we have to brainstorm a bit about, okay, what is like an operation that you can normally do like another marketplace? And what is a way to bring that analog into something on Chain? And then three is like trying to get people internally on the team to be using the product and noticing like pain points. So ensuring that people on the team are power users, so they can identify things themselves of, hey, I really wanted to see that this stat isn't showing up. And then adding that to the list of things to do.
So it's basically just adhering to the community and telling your team and making priorities off that, right?
Ideally, yeah.
Ideally, but is there sometimes conflict?
Yeah, there's always like only so much you can do. Some things like sound easy, but end up being hard.
Yeah, and I imagine like the community would also be demanding of these as well at times. How do you manage sort of holding the community back while trying to help them understand that it takes time to develop and bring out new features?
I think that having more like incremental updates is useful. I think that's something that I've shied away from more in the past, so I'm leaning more into that now. Otherwise, I think that this is where I'm at ideally, right? As the team internally, right, you have to be good at prioritizing. If there's things that there's a lot of user like demand and feedback for, right, I think it's really important that you implement it, but you can't just have all of your product decisions dictated like just from feedback alone.
Yeah. Because ultimately you're the dev that's building everything together, and more than, I guess, the users. But the users are the people that are that power the product. So I guess it is, you have to balance this in some way. But having the incremental updates, I think, definitely does help. It doesn't leave them in the dark. Even if you're building like a big feature, right, you're still updating them of the progress. So I guess managing a community is also like a big skill that you've learned over this time. And I guess if you were to look back at it, how would you basically start this whole journey again and accelerate this journey into the point where you are now, or even get further? What were some kind of hit stops you had to take and realizations you found on the way?
Yeah, I think that the two things that I think I didn't do as much of looking back that I'm like really curious how things would have gone if I had done them was, one, being more ambitious at the start.
How were you not ambitious though?
If you're building like self-contained projects, right, you're like not necessarily expecting one of them to just blow up.
Yeah.
And then figuring out how to scale an app to the point where you like want to be targeting like 10x the number of users, I think, is a different type of mindset.
Right.
There's that. And then I think that when I switched to building on top of all the like pseudoswap protocol things full time, there was probably an opportunity to be doing a more like early preview build, or like some sort of like canary or like alpha program to be getting more feedback. And I think that would have also been interesting to see. So
why do you think about the preview?
Yeah, I think that especially I think for like smart contract stuff, right? There's always like a pretty long development cycle between getting the sort of idea set up, then contracts written, tested, then audited, and then shipped out. So I think that if there was a way to maybe cap the like amount that was at risk, then you can do like more interesting things with code, with the idea that like, hey, if there's like really good reception, then eventually like it goes through like the whole like safety pipeline, but then you can get like more like early validation on some of the stuff. I feel like it's always difficult when you have like more users, because then you can't just introduce something more haphazardly because like more people are at stake. But then if you have people who like opt in or understand that there's like a higher degree of like potential fault, then you can experiment a bit more.
I wonder if that's something you're going to take on now, though. So when you ship out a new feature, maybe you'll do like a little alpha or preview stage for a certain select of people. Or is there something else?
I've been doing like a weekly sort of experimental series on ways to like hack on top of the pools. And I think like eventually that ends up finding its way into like a more playground style site where like again, like the tolerance for like fault might be like a lot lower. Like there might be things that break, and then making sure that people understand that. So having that be in like a separate portion rather than the main site where there are more users, and making sure that security is like the priority when people go onto the main site.
For sure. I think developing a preview is a very important thing. And I wonder how it would even be done if the preview requires like an MVP that would take a while to happen. But I guess after you have that first MVP, then you can start introducing like more frequent quote unquote previews, just to see what features people like when you implement them, get some feedback from that. If it's good, then you go basically continue down that path until you hit bedrock, and then move on to another branch and see if that goes well or not. But yeah, you basically have to get like an MVP, right? Before you can even do this preview kind of stuff. So was there anything that kind of dictated your development path prior to that, prior to the MVP?
Prior to the MVP, I think the main goal was, like the first goal was like adherence to the ideas sketched out in like the original written version. Okay, at minimum, we want to have a reference implementation of the ideas here. That was the original vision. And then from there, I think the secondary driving force was some of the stuff that I mentioned around parity, which was like, how can you craft this to behave more like a marketplace? That stuff on like the aggregation level.
I wonder what your process was for basically building out the initial idea on paper and then going from there. There must have been a lot of basically divergence from the original idea, I assume, for something so complicated. Is that kind of true? Or
I think that high level, hopefully people sort of looking at the original PDF and then looking at the system are like, oh, I can see how this is an implementation. I do think that there was some stuff that had to be worked out on the math side to ensure no arbitrage for LPs. So that had to dictate some of the decisions around how that stuff was coded. That was one thing that changed. And then something that's been like a lot more top of mind, or has been since like the first version came out, was like, how do you do aggregation, like pricing, Oracle stuff on the contract level? And hopefully some of those designs can start being experimented on now.
Are you talking more of basically an NFT Oracle or something like that?
So to give an example, there's some demand probably for some sort of NFT TWAP, or there's some demand for letting people share in a concentrated range position. Both of these are finicky to get right.
A lot of complexity. Have you ever thought of any ideas that you wanted to implement?
One of the things that originally it was slated for the V1 release that never made it in was like the idea of these time-based auctions after the Paradigm GDA paper came out. And then that was something that made it into the like V2 release, which I was excited about. So sometimes things just get moved later down in the roadmap. This one was still a little bit gross if people have peeped the code. Basically, the bonding curves in general are supposed to be relatively pure. In the ideal case, it's just a function of like where the pool's pricing currently is and like how much the user wants to be buying or selling. But in the case of the GDA curve, you also have to be taking into account like the block timestamp, And then as a result, like, you have to store back like the updated timestamp. So there's some bit shifting and packing that goes into ensuring that the timestamp is something that can be stored as like a future parameter.
Yeah. And this is basically all on-chain as well. It wouldn't be any off-chain stuff, right?
Yeah. So it's just a function of like, when did the swap last happen and when is the swap happening now?
Yeah. I wonder, anything on-chain Oracle related or just Oracles in general, it's always tricky to think about how basically a black hat would try and manipulate it, right? I think that's an incredibly difficult task. How can you prevent basically Oracle manipulation? What are the scenarios it comes in and stuff like that?
I think in contrast to something where you're just saying, oh, you know, we'll be listening to all the prices off-chain, we'll run some outlier detection, and then we'll report the results. If you're like Oracle is a function of on-chain activities, then you're making it very clear like what inputs go into the process. And then you can open it up for people who, as you mentioned, like black hats, to start thinking about, oh, this lever is like really easy to pull, things like that.
And what kind of made you think of basically the multiple pool, what do you call it? Like multiple pools within a collection? Because then you've got fragmented liquidity in a collection. So what kind of made you go with that instead of just one big pool for all the liquidity?
Yeah, I think that there is like a spectrum with the way that these things are handled, right? One is the UniV2 model where everyone is like splitting fees proportionally. And then, as has already been discussed to death, one of the things that's lacking is that you don't have very good price control, which for certain high volatility assets like shitcoins, preferring UniV2 is a totally fine design choice. One of the things that was a big design decision for the pseudo AMM was letting people be very particular about which prices they wanted to enter and exit at. Trade-off there is if you really want precision there, then aggregation becomes difficult. For like UniV3 or the Trader Joe liquidity book model, they solve that by having tick sizing. There's still like notion of what the discrete step size is, and then you can do some clever math to keep track of like where people are starting and ending their range. But when it comes to NFTs, like each NFT is already like a specific unit size, right? Like you buy and sell with basically a decimals of zero. So in that case, like picking a range doesn't make as much sense, right? Like if you're picking a range of 1 to 100 ETH, but you're only putting in 5 NFTs, then they're not being like necessarily equally sold between 1 100 ETH, right? Like you can't actually spread them out equally amongst the range in the same way that you could spread out like 5 DAI across the range. So the original thinking there was like, instead of thinking about it in terms of ranges, what if we think about it in terms of some sort of like discrete function that reports back like the next step? Instead of picking a range, you're picking some sort of step function that takes you from the next discrete price increment to the subsequent one. And then in that case, or at least looking at it 2 years ago, the math for figuring that out was really messy if you imagined that everyone was like a singleton contract. I think there's probably ways to cut a bit more corners now that we've spent 2 years looking at the code to get it right. But at the time, I was just like, okay, we want everybody to keep track of their own prices, and we want people to know like which NFTs are theirs. You have to resort to certain things like auctions or fractionalization in the case where you have three people that are sharing a pool of two NFTs, or you often do in like some of these models, fractional or NFTX. And then again, the idea is like, okay, one easy answer is just like whatever enters the pool is yours, and then you don't have to worry about that necessarily. So those are some of the reasons that led to the design.
Yeah, for sure. I think pricing NFTs is quite a difficult task because it's all subjective. And I guess you have different rarities and people think of them at different prices, right? So like a 0.01% rarity versus a 50% rarity seems like they should be a big difference in price. But ultimately, that's up to the person that's buying and selling. The original model of Uniswap V2 would never work on paper because it's all subjective, and there can be like massive price differences of what people are selling them on. For example, the 0.01% rarity thing might be going for a million, and then the 50% might be going for 1,000. So it's like a massive jump, and the ranges wouldn't really make sense math-wise for that.
Yeah, so separately, there's always like the floor versus like rare discussion. I think this is why the sort of direct AMM model also has like difficulties compared to order book, because in certain cases, you're really depending on the person taking the order to care about the rarity. Also in certain cases, like traits that aren't even that rare might just be desirable for like external reasons. like the Familiars or this collection where they're like these cute little gremlins, fairies, spirits, and they're each tied to the price of a specific cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, Link, Ethereum. And they're evenly split, but because the collections on ETH, the ones that track the price of ETH were commanding a much higher premium, like at 2x the original price. But it's not like they're 2x as rare compared to everything else, right?
Exactly. You have to basically price off the crowd. And it's interesting how it works, because it's not using basically any other marketplace. It's basically little modules that people create, or yeah, little pools contained with their own, I guess you can call it a mini collection, a collection within a collection. And then people fight for that instead of just going like floor. Okay, what's the highest one? What's the lowest one? Let's try and sell above the floor and keep going higher until it gets to a point where it just is at like a ridiculous price. Yeah, it's an interesting way. I don't know if many people have done like this kind of AMM strategy either. I remember when I first saw NFTX, I thought that was brilliant, but then that doesn't solve the rarity and subjective price value.
I was going to ask if you trade NFTs yourself at all.
No, I don't. I was always involved in like the Phantom NFT community kind of side. And I was really into building like bots for that. So I was building like an NFT auction house on Discord for Tombheads. But I think those days have passed now, unfortunately. And then after that, I just got into basically normal dev and tooling, going into form of verification, stuff like that. I always had friends that traded NFTs, and it was always just sweep the floor, put it up higher and wait. And that was it. Like, I think at the time Genie came out, and that was pretty like revolutionary, I think. Like, people just started using that, and then they would go on OpenSea. It was basically just OpenSea and Genie. Obviously, OpenSea is just still popping off. I haven't seen much about Genie anymore, but they're probably still going.
Genie got acquired by Uniswap, actually.
Oh, yes, I remember that.
A little while ago.
Yeah, Genie was quite good because it was more tooling. I think anything tool-wise for NFTs is terrific, because it is such like a high complexity task to build something that prices NFTs or something along those lines, or even just adding anything on top of NFTs. I think something like, what was it called? Yam Finance. They're doing like insurance and I think derivatives of NFTs, or someone else is doing derivatives, but that it becomes just even more complex. I could be wrong on that, but I wonder if you're thinking of pivoting to anything else, or you just want to keep going in the NFT thing and try and keep on innovating.
I think that we've yet to hit like peak Ouroboros entities in entities yet for NFTs. And I think that like at that point, I might think that things have saturated. But I think that for right now, the design space is still really large and I think largely unexplored. So I still want to keep pushing there until we have our own liquidity layer on top of Convex Flywheel that's like eating emissions for some other token. I don't think we've peaked.
Yeah, and it's such a difficult journey as well. I think the problems with NFTs is much more complex than normal ERC-20s by a long shot. Just because that subjective value kind of stuff. It's quite interesting. How did you even get into all of this NFT tooling stuff to begin with? Because you just started with OXMons and then you just thought of like this idea, or was it just something that was missing and you needed?
Yeah, so I would say that one of the things that wasn't around like 2 years ago for marketplaces was having these more advanced orders. Of, oh, I just want to take profit across like these prices, or I'm willing to make a collection offer at these prices. So that was definitely part of it. So I like traded NFTs myself. I was a big fan of the art blocks drops, minted a hash mask, did not mint a Bored Ape. So probably via the biggest L of my career.
Hashmask was pretty big. That kind of took off everything. I remember there was even a hackathon right after that as well.
Yeah, I participated in that. So there was like the whole thing about like hashmasks that you can name them, right? And
yeah,
then, like
yeah.
Names are supposed to be unique. But then like some people would like squat names, and then people were like, oh, maybe if you have a really impressive name, people will want it. So I built this tool that would let two people swap the names of their hashmasks.
Oh, interesting.
So you have to do that atomically because the names can't be put up for sale, right? So basically, like, both people agree, and then the contract like escrows both, and then like it does a swap, like changes the first name to the placeholder, the second name to the first name, and then the name back.
And did people have to basically, how would this process work? Would they just approve their hash mask?
So similar to the OTC stuff, like both users would have to agree to it.
Okay, so it was like an approved kind of way, not custodial.
The contract would have to hold both of the NFTs during the duration, but at the end of the transaction, you get the asset back.
Okay, so the person like initiating the transaction is basically pulling the other person's NFT into the contract, their NFT into the contract, then like switching the names, then distributing them both back. Did this ever pop off?
It did not, but neither did hash masks after their blaze of glory. So it's what it is.
Yeah, it really was a blaze of glory. It was, I think that's what took the NFT scene to the next level, because they raised so much money in such a short amount of time.
They kicked off the whole bonding curve idea, or the idea of selling NFTs along with some price, and that demonstrating there was demand for that kind of model.
Yeah, it was quite interesting because the whole sort of ecosystem of the set of the hash mask was, or the economy of the hash mask was all just name change token. And that was the driving feature.
They kicked off like the idea of 10K, the idea of like generally flat pricing, and they had a token tied to it. Really was a very good project to kick things off.
Yeah, it was like a threshold kind of model, which actually made me want to build my own platform. I built like a fully decentralized NFT like launchpad, which had basically the hash mask model of the thresholds. So let's say 5% of the supply is sold at 0.1, 10% of the supply is, and it keeps going on. I had that. I had bonding curves, even built in like an auction kind of mechanism. And this was all fully decentralized as well, which is quite interesting. It never took off, but it was a nice little project. But then I realized all that stuff, any kind of dApps require basically great front end skills, at least for me. I didn't really have the front end skills to make it worthwhile, especially a launchpad, that because you need things to visualize. So that's when my dApp career died and then went straight into backend. Yeah, but I think a lot of NFT stuff also requires backend as well, like databases, if you want to do some tooling. Nothing is really fully on chain anymore, I think.
Yeah, I think the gripe that always comes up is like where the metadata is, figuring that out, or like even just keeping track of it. If you're running a site that has to display information, is always messy. Like you're probably gonna have to tap into some other service, or you're gonna have to beef up your own servers and run your like own indexer. There's always this backend stuff involved that's maybe not immediately apparent.
Yeah, for sure. I wonder if you were ever approached for investors, if you ever did a raise for a pseudoswap.
Yeah, so on the corp side, which is where everyone's hired, we did raise a little while ago.
Oh, nice. How did that go? What was the kind of process for raising?
Mostly just overall just exhausting, right? Like you're always talking to like various people about getting it set up. I think that there's like a lot of like really, I'd say overall the experience is good. I think a lot of people are like understanding, and like when it comes to finding your fit, there's a lot of different ambitions that people have with like how they see the product or how they want to work with you. I would say that depending on like the vision that you have, there's probably someone that is there and is like on board with it. I think
Yeah.
there's a definite variety there.
How did you really find these people as well? Did they just come and approach you, or did you have other people referring them to you?
Yeah, usually it's like referrals from friends again.
Oh, interesting. So let's say you didn't have any friends, theoretically, and you didn't have these referrals, but did you really need to raise, or was it just something that came up and you're like, oh, why not? Let's get some money and try and expand some more.
Yeah, so it was more of the second, or I think part of the second one, but also like at sort of the point then, the team was very small, wasn't going to be possible for one person to be managing like all the front end and as well as the periphery stuff.
So you basically just use the money to hire people to do some big task or small tasks. Or was it used all basically to hire, not contra?
Yeah, hiring was like number one priority.
And then how did you do like marketing? Because do you have any people marketing in your team, or is it just all tech and then business side?
There's one person handling BD things. I do think that it's something worth scaling up on. I think that definitely in general, outreach is difficult because there's only so much attention to spread around. So I do think that's something like it's worth thinking more about.
Especially in an era where everybody's just got short attention spans as well. And everyone's just doom scrolling. You definitely need a marketing team if you want to get to the next level, or at least someone that does marketing. It's something what I realize as well. You can have such an amazing product, but if you have no marketing and nobody knows about it, then nobody can use the amazing product. More often than not, especially in the NFT scene, is they just gas up on marketers and don't really build the tech to be anything innovative or something like that. It's all just hype, which, I mean, it works. It's a scale. You need a mix of both. Basically, what you mentioned before for doing this whole process again of building PseudoSwap from the ground up, you know, getting the team to where it is now and hiring, all that process, there's only two things you would do differently, which is do previews more.
I think that it's that, and then I think those are definitely like probably the two ones for sure, like the preview stuff, and then trying to think about more users and building, thinking with more scaling in mind.
Yeah. Is there any kind of like other directions you would take when building a startup? Because it wasn't intended to be a startup, was it?
The very first version wasn't, right? Like the OTC stuff being like a side project to start.
Yeah. At one point, did you think you should turn this into a startup?
I think that it wasn't until like partway through building like the initial first marketplace version. And then even then, like talking to people about like interest was mixed until post-launch.
Because I guess it's difficult to think when to transition, especially if you built something that you just were doing it as a hobby. The only real way is if you initially have the idea of basically creating a startup, or if someone tells you you should turn it into a startup. What did your schedule look like at that time as well? Were you just focusing on random stuff all around, or were you like full-time and at a job? How did you go about your day at the starting and the same now?
Yeah, I think that the biggest difference is probably like time spent talking with other people, where if you're doing like dev primarily, then you have less interactions. But now it's talking to the people on the team, making sure people are on the same page, stuff like that.
I think this was pretty insightful. I think a lot of people would get quite a lot of value from this and hopefully are entertained. Yeah, it's been such a pleasure talking to you, Owen. It's been great finally chatting to you, finally, after a year or two has passed. Yeah, and hopefully I can chat again soon and hopefully see the flourishing of PseudoSwap and what's next to come. Yeah, of course. Thank you so much, and I hope everyone has a good day.